according to his promise. We are looking for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Therefore, beloved, since you look for these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, spotless and blameless, and grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. All right. We are ready for chapter 11. Welcome. Good to have you with us today. Chapter 11, historiography, the historical precondition. Did you do the reading? Was it easier than last week?
I thought so.
Yeah. 9 and 10, I tell you. All right. Yeah, those are rough chapters, like chapter 1 and, or chapter 2, one of those. And then chapter, back to the same, and anytime they bring up Parmenides, I'm like, seriously, we're going back to this guy again? Anyway, now today is much easier. Next week will be better. So we have this week is chapter 11. Next week is chapter 12. Week after that, we'll have the two appendixes, appendix 1 and appendix 2. And then that will finish up the first part here of the prolegomena. Then we'll be ready for the bibliology, and we'll take that. We'll announce that reading schedule as we get closer and deal with those things. All right. Let's begin with a word of prayer, dedicating our time for the glory of Jesus Christ. Heavenly Father, we come before you this afternoon once again, unworthy, but made worthy. We thank you for your grace. We thank you for the righteousness of Jesus Christ imputed to our account. We thank you for the standing that we have in Christ. And so as we stand before you, workmen needing not to be ashamed, we ask for your guidance and wisdom, blessing as we study. Open our eyes, lead us into these things. Help us to read with discernment. We thank you and we praise you, Father, in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. All right, so again, we're wrapping up the final of these preconditions. This week is historical. Next week is the methodological, the method that we employ in our theology. If you're not using the right method, you're going to have a bad outcome. So we'll deal with that next week. But historiography, and this is one of my favorites simply because I love it so much. And I love it because it's real. And I love the fact that we live in the real world, and it's the same world that the Bible takes place in. That the thing when Jesus walked this earth, it's the real truth in the real world. We're not reading a book about Narnia or a make-believe land of whatever, Middle Earth or Tolkien. No, this is the real world, and he walked it, and we can appreciate that. Unlike some religions, historical Christianity is inseparably tied to historical events. It makes those historical claims. It's not written in some mythic, beyond history, kind of way. No, we have the lives of these guys, Adam, Abraham, Moses, David, Jesus. They all happened in the real world, and if they didn't happen, then we're not saved. If these are make-believe stories, if this is fiction, if the things the Bible records are not historically true, then we don't have eternal life. And the Bible's full of lies, okay? Because the Bible describes things that actually literally happened. And so we take it that way. The Apostle Paul puts it best in 1 Corinthians 15 that we are most to be pitied, that if there is no resurrection, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain. Your faith is in vain. If he is not raised, in fact, we're just most to be pitied at this point because it's necessary. Yeah, there it is, verse 19. If we have hoped in Christ in this life only, we are of all men most to be pitied. How sad is it? If this Bible is not true, if there is no resurrection, if there's no eternity, then what are we doing? Okay, and that is actually factually true. So, the knowability of history is important, not only theologically, but also apologetically, for the overall argument in defense of Christianity is based upon the historicity of the New Testament documents. And some of that will come up in the bibliology portion. We're going to talk about why do we think the New Testament is reliable, and why do we think that it has credible information available to us that we can accept on a historical basis, so that we'll have that coming up still. He will reference that several times in the course of this chapter. So the objective knowability of history is strongly challenged by many contemporary historians. It is necessary to counter this claim in order to secure the defense of Christianity. And it's interesting. I don't know why. People, you'll find skeptics that will deny anything. You find people that will deny whatever. You can find some flat earthers somewhere. We didn't go to the moon. It was a Hollywood production or whatever. Holocaust denial. There's tons of denial. There's even a denial that says that the Middle Ages was invented, and there was, you know, there's an extra three centuries that didn't really happen, but our calendars were all corrupted and different things. I mean, you'll find, if there's a weird theory out there, you'll find somebody defending it. Okay, and so then you have to say, well, on what basis is that a crackpot thing, and on what basis can I objectively say, no, this is the truth of what really happened? How do we gauge what we find reliable? And the folks that don't want to admit history is what it is, I find that interesting because usually they've got other motivations for why, right? The communist Chinese, the Soviets, all, you know, the idea of denying the past was huge for them because they didn't like that. They wanted to talk about the present and the future and this great utopia that they're taking everybody to. And so they stamp out the past. There was a news story this weekend about a book on Chinese history that goes back to some dynasty thousands of years ago, and they don't even want that out there, right? It's crazy. They want to deny the past. So much of this chapter is redundant from what we've already studied. The same arguments that are employed that, well, you can't really know history were used earlier on why you can't really know anything or why you can't really communicate or why language falls short or things like that. So today may actually go pretty quickly if we find that all of this redundancy is paying off. And it ought to be just natural, even for, and I get it, some people don't like history just as a school topic. That's fine, you know, because they prefer whatever. But we all have a history. Each one of us has an individual personal history, right? Where I was born, where I went to school, where I grew up, where I, all these things. And it is real. It's part of what brought me to where I am today. And if we each have that personally, and everyone can testify that they have that, their lived experience from whenever until now, well, then why is it so outrageous to think that nations and cultures and humanity has something similar, right? Because it's just a sequence of people from generation to generation that lived and died and did things in between. So assuming that those things are written down and in ways that we have no reason to suspect, then we're fine with it. So, objections to the objectivity of history. And I'll just tell you right now, they're bogus. Okay, and you know it already if you've read, and you think, man, they are just trying as hard as they can to reject these things. So anyway, he's very fair, more fair than I would ever want to be. And some of these are worth looking at. They're all in this bibliography if you want to pull those up and do additional reading on the topics. But if these disputations are valid, they make the essential historical basis of Christianity both unknowable and unverifiable. So if we can't know anything about history, then we have no reason to accept the Bible on a historical basis. And so he breaks them out into these six categories: epistemological, axiological, methodological, metaphysical, psychological, and hermeneutical. It just goes one by one by one, and he lays them out there. He's very fair, I think, in all of these approaches. Once he gets top to the bottom through all those, then he goes back and he shows why we have a solid case to make with the historicity of the Bible. Which, side note, since we had our visitors here 2 weeks ago, the ministry that he has on campuses to Mormon people is staggering, because everything we're saying today about Christianity is absolutely the polar opposite with respect to Mormonism, right? So you read the Book of Mormon, you read the Pearl of Great Price, you read any of their writings, they've got all these legends and stories of things that supposedly happened in the North American continent way back when, okay? But there's no historicity behind any of it, and there's no archaeology that has found any of it, and there's no reality to any of it. And in fact, there's so much that's just been demonstrably proven as fraudulent. It's staggering to me. I don't think people cling to Mormonism intellectually. They cling to it emotionally, and then they build a fabric on top of that. Anyway, we'll start with these one by one. Epistemological. Epistemology. This is the realm of how we know stuff. The fact, and you'll find skeptics that will try to prove that you can't know anything, which makes me laugh, because how do you know that? If you tell me that you don't know anything, how do you know that you don't know anything? If it's not possible to know anything, then you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot. Anyway, the unobservability of history. So, all right, we're not like scientists doing experiments in a test tube. We can't really view it in the present. We're just trying to interpret data from the past, and so it's not repeatable because the data we have from the past, it is what it is, and you can't repeat the past in the present. This is the approach that they're making. The historian does not deal with past events, but with statements about past events. Okay, fine. I have no problem with that. A lot of statements about past events, and how do we evaluate the statements? Are they credible? Are they reliable? Are they corroborated by other eyewitness accounts? Just because they're statements about past events doesn't mean we just ignore it and throw it out. So, but because of that, it enables the historian to use their imagination to try to interpret those statements, to try to rephrase them, to understand them, to cast them in a different light, to try to, I think a lot of times with revisionism, they try to make the facts tell a different story than they're actually telling on their face. Anyway, so he goes into some of these and the authors that are holding those views. Two reasons offered as to why the historian only has indirect access to the past. First is claim, unlike a scientist, the historian's world is composed of records and not events. Why a historian must contribute a reconstructed picture of the past. And in this sense, the past is really the product of the present. In other words, it's fine, but it's an imaginative, creative product of the interpreter and how he chose to present the data. And there were things maybe he left out. There were things that he overemphasized. And really, we're just dealing with a meta-narrative that these biased people are trying to force upon us. Curious how they always, doesn't seem to you anyway, am I over-reading this? Where they keep attributing these nefarious motives to these flawed historians with an agenda, while they present these scientists as if they're pure as the wind-driven snow and they have no agenda and they just deal with data and experiments. Anyway, as if they're not interpreting things. So we can get through that. All right, fragmentary nature of historical accounts. Well, because we don't have everything, then we can't have anything. If we don't know all of it, we can't know any of it. And a flawed approach to that. So sure, fragmentary nature of things and incomplete data and whatever, but within the scope of what we do have, we can paint a very good picture for a whole lot of human history. And I like to use kind of the Solomon as the ballpark. Anything that's more recent than Solomon, we've got a pretty solid grounds on almost all of it, because we have corroborating records. We have Babylonian, Assyrian, Egyptian, Greek. We got all these corroborating records that we can coordinate one to another, and we can be very solid. When you get beyond 1000 BC and you're headed back prior to Solomon, then it gets more sketchy because we don't have all of the interrelated records that can synchronize as well as since the time since Solomon. Anyway, is it fragmentary? Of course. But we don't say that defeats even the effort of trying. Obviously not. Within the fraction of what we have, we can build the information. The historical conditioning of the historian. Yeah, well, he's the product of his time. And as such, he's subject to the unconscious programming of his era. Now, obviously, everybody's a subject of their time. Everybody is you know, exists and grew up and writes and thinks, you know, in a manner consistent to the day and age that they live in. And that's a good thing, honestly, because I'm hoping that should the Lord delay long enough, and if the church age actually lasts longer than I expect it will, I'm hoping there will come a day that we get kind of beyond our current woke generation and we can get to a standard that has some kind of normalcy to it. As that may. Anyway, the idea that it's unreliable because he's just writing the history based upon his own norms and standards. Axiological value. Historian cannot avoid making value judgments. And I'm okay with that. I'm fine with value judgments. Go ahead. And if you're going to write a history from a Christian worldview, I prefer that. Okay, throw your value judgments out there. And if you want to write about, if you want to write about two armies that are fighting and an army of savages, well, I'm fine with that. Use whatever languages you want to use, because they communicate within the realm that they're approaching. So I don't have any issue with value judgments. I don't have any issue with any text, and especially if you know what that judgment is up front. Okay? It's interesting to me that the last time I was in the Philippines, I've been there twice, and we toured, I guess it was the first time I went over there, with Larry Hoffman, and we toured Corregidor. And there was a huge part of World War II, and the Japanese had conquered it, and we took it back. And then it's an amazing bit of history. And this island of Corregidor in Manila Bay, we get there off the little ferry boat, and we stand on the thing, and we're walking out. And they told us this going over. They said there's going to be a line of 8 buses. And they said, we don't care what bus you get on, just make sure it's one of the first 7 buses. Okay? Because those are the buses where the tour is given in English. And then the 8th bus, the tour is given in Japanese. Okay? So you can expect that even though it's the same island, the same war, the same history, the same data, the perspective is totally different from the English-speaking world and there was a lot of Americans and Brits and Aussies and different things. And then the Japanese perspective, okay? Because they took it and then they lost it and then different things there. So yeah, just know what your bias is and deal with it. And not a problem with values being inserted. Methodological objections relating to the procedure by which history is done. And then within this, we'll talk about this. There are several methodological objections to the belief in objective history necessary to establish the truth of Christianity. And so he goes into a few of these. First of all, the selective nature. That the cherry picking, the idea that these written accounts they don't include everything, that they've only included the details they want in order to make them look good or build their case or support their argument or whatever. It's actually a flawed argument to start with, because if you know anything about the Bible records a whole lot of things that are embarrassing. You know, details about David's sin with Bathsheba, details about Abraham and his lack of faith. And I mean, there's just all of these ugly stories that are in the Bible. And you think, well, why didn't those selective Bible writers leave those bad parts out? Okay. So anyway, it's a bit of a flawed argument and a problem that's not as big as they make it out to be. So, fragmentary information, fragmentary interpretation, all of that. Influenced by many subjective and relative factors. Well, you know what? Same thing with the reader. I'm reading that history and I've got subjective factors. I've got personal prejudices. Anyway. So they argue the facts don't speak for themselves. Well, why not? Okay. They can. And even if some of the facts are in dispute, you still can weigh the arguments in favor and against. You can weigh the credibility of the issues. So why do you not let the facts speak for themselves? Did Columbus sail in 1492? Well, why not? Why do you say that? Isn't that just your opinion? You know? Who cares if it was written down somewhere? The people that wrote that down had an agenda, right? Well, no, stop. They wrote it down, but their purpose was not to deceive people hundreds of years later. They wrote it down, and their purpose was to record what was happening. You know, we have ship logs, we have journeys, we have journals, we have diaries. And even in our legal system today, if somebody is writing in their diaries, the things, their thoughts, their dreams, their whatever, their fears. Personal diaries are always admissible. They're always credible. It's unthinkable that somebody was lying to themselves in their diary. Okay? Unless politically you have to convince a court, oh, I was lying to myself in my diary. Anyway. the need to select and arrange historical materials. That's not an objection. I think it's a feature, okay? It's not a bug, it's a feature. I like that. I love arranging and selecting and arranging historical materials because very frequently there's just an avalanche of data and you've got to filter through it. You've got to find a way to simplify and to remove the extraneous things so that a coherent historical narrative can be presented. So that's not an issue. Not an issue at all. But they will object to it. All right, then we get into metaphysical objections. Some of these we've discussed in previous chapters as well. Metaphysical objections have been leveled against the belief in objective history, predicated either theoretically or practically on the premise that one's worldview colors the study of history. All right, so it does. Who cares? It doesn't change what it is. Okay, if it's slanted, it's slanted. Great. But what's it saying? Partial knowledge of the past makes it necessary for the historian to fill in the gaping holes out of his own imagination. Really? I think it's the opposite. I think that when the information is sketchy, okay, you can come to a tentative conclusion, but I think all historians are, you know, they don't want to be, no historian wants to be known 100 years after they're dead as a complete buffoon that got it all wrong because he was just making up stuff out of nowhere. They don't want that as a legacy, right? Because every historian knows that they're building on earlier historians and then people after them are going to build on them. Anyway, you know who's filling in gaping holes? How about paleontologists that find a jawbone and then try to create a whole skeleton off of a jawbone? And then they have artwork on skin and feathers and colors and all kinds of stuff that, and all they have is a jawbone. Okay? How about filling in the holes? And they're the type that aren't at all concerned about being embarrassed by later discoveries because they're on the same team with all the same bogus objectives. Get me off of that soapbox here. Yeah, I have no problem with sorting material and classifying them and selectively including and excluding, and all of that's absolutely necessary. And we have examples of that in the Bible. Okay. We saw Psalm 106 earlier today where there was a kind of a summary of the Exodus and the wilderness wanderings and the conquest. And in the development of Psalm 106, the psalmist omitted a lot of information and included information and classified it and he sorted it. And there's just nothing wrong with that. Why are you objecting to something that's actually normal? The unavoidability of worldviews. All right. I'm okay with that. Unless it so poisons what you're writing about that you can't, and that can then become a problem, right? If you are absolutely dedicated to a wheel of time kind of cycles of history that are just eternal and never ending, and it's always been this way, it'll always be this way, then if that saturates your approach, then that can color your writing and damage your historical conclusions. I get that. But those that are defending true human history and true biblical history, that worldview does not lend itself to the artificial fiction. Does that make sense? Because the Christian worldview is dedicated to the truth. They're saved by the way, the truth, and the life. They're absolutely committed to the data, whatever it says, wherever it leads them, on an objective basis. And I think that makes all the difference in the world, in my opinion. Does that make sense? Any questions on that? It just seems to me like, it's like I tell people with archaeology and manuscripts and whatever, I don't care. I'm not afraid of any manuscript they might find. It doesn't scare me if they turn up a book they think should be in the Bible or whatever. You know, whatever. We'll look at it. What's the manuscript say? What's it like? You know, when was it written? Never got all fancy about the Time magazine thing about this Gospel of Judas, as if there was a huge conspiracy to hide the Gospel of Judas from everybody. And no, it's been known about for a long time, and church fathers have written about it. It doesn't belong in the Bible, and we're not hiding it from anybody. It's just you were clueless enough until recently that you didn't even know it was there. So we can let that go. Anyway. He does mention theodicy. Did you see that word there? Are you familiar with theodicy? I think it's on your quiz. No, it's not. Okay. Not on your quiz. Well, never mind. But no, theodicy is an interesting term. And, it kind of comes back to the question of evil, the problem of evil. Why does God allow bad things to happen? Is he still just? Is he still ruling over the world even when bad things do happen? And things there that apologists have addressed over the years. Miracles are by nature super historical. So much of this comes back to what we saw already on the miracles as a precondition. If there is a theistic universe, if there is a God, then miracles are possible. So why are we struggling with this? But I guess they make this objection that, well, you know, history is one thing, but really? Somebody rose from the dead? You know, that doesn't happen. We don't have other historical records of that, so that must not be historical. Maybe it's not history. Maybe it's Geschichte. Did I say that right? Geschichte. It's a German word, and you've got to be careful. It can sound like a different German word, and you can actually get a little bit vulgar with this, which I think... We had a Schaefer speaker a couple years ago that was doing a lot of that. Michael Rydelnik was throwing a lot of German language out there. Made us all laugh. But the Geschichte, the difference between the history and the historic, the idea of the image that it produces, or the this is actually a nice section here. I didn't highlight it, but it's worth reading. Spiritual history, allegedly, has no necessary connection with the spatio-temporal continuum of empirical events. Well, that's a long phrase. It just means it didn't really happen. Okay? Noah's flood didn't really happen. Adam and Eve weren't real people. Okay? But it's a spiritual history. It's a myth. It's got subjective religious significance, but no objective grounding. So, no real Adam and Eve, but there's a myth so that there's a religious lesson we can get out of it. It can have a significance to us even if it wasn't really true. And, okay, you can defend a theory like that because that's kind of where Islam is and Mormonism and a whole ton of other religions. It's where Hinduism is. A lot of these world religions are kind of in that realm. Not historically accurate, but they approach it as if it's just this myth that they live by. That's not how the Bible presents itself, and that's not how we accept the Bible. It's not how we interpret it. It's not how we read it. And in fact, theologically, we can't read it. If Adam and Eve were not real people, then the whole message of the first Adam, the second Adam, the whole message of being condemned in Adam and being redeemed by the second Adam, all of that's gone. When Jesus dies on the cross, he can't be the second Adam if there really wasn't a first Adam. You see what I'm saying? If Adam and Eve is just myth, if it's just a story, if it's not real, then we're not saved. Because it requires the reality of Adam's original sin for the second Adam to redeem us from that sin. Anyway. Geschichte is a story made up of events probably never happened, but they inspire men to some moral or religious good. Okay? So, I mean, it's like the boy who cried wolf. It probably never really happened, but we can learn from it. Right? It makes sense. Don't tell lies. They won't believe you when it's really true. Or the emperor has no clothes. All right? Probably didn't really happen, but it's a fable. It's a myth. We can learn a principle from it. And we have those common myths and common legends and whatever you want to call them, fables, but that's not the Bible. The Bible is a historical revelation written by eyewitnesses. Anyway, remember the bad guys we introduced you to last week? Paul Tillich was one on that list. Here he is again. Claim that is disastrous distortion in the meaning of faith to identify it with belief in the historical validity of biblical stories. So Paul Tillich thinks it's a train wreck if you believe in the flood or Adam and Eve or any of these historical, you know, Jonah and the whale. Come on. Okay? You can't believe that really happened. But it's Geschichte. Soren Kierkegaard, the important thing is whether or not it evokes an appropriate religious response. No, the whole, what's important is if it's true or if it's false. That's what's important. If it's true, I want to learn it. If it's false, it comes from Satan. I have no interest. Rudolf Bultmann, remember he demythologized the Bible. Sigurd Ogden. Yep, absolutely. And much of today's liberal theology is on board with that. Anyway, we have no problem with miracles because we have a God that can do what he wants. Miracles are in principle historically unknowable. No, not true. We have the records of those who saw the miracles. They saw it, they wrote about it, we have the records, we have the testimony. We can't recreate the events, but we have the testimony that the event took place. Why is that any different than anything else? Right? I believe George Washington was the first president of the United States, but I wasn't alive then. I just learned that from written accounts. I learned that from school. I learned that, and it's I can't recreate it in a test tube. It's something from the past. There are accounts of the past that are reliable. All right. Psychological objections. History recorded by persons with religious motives cannot be trusted. Oh, please. Well, I mean, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they had an agenda, obviously. They're trying to start a new religion. They're trying to break free from the Jews. They're trying to, you know, so they had these ulterior motives. You can't believe the Bible because none of the authors were objective. They were all subjective. They were all on board. Okay? It's just garbage. Okay? I want to use stronger words. Scubalon. Okay? It's all crap. I mean, it's what it is. And it's curious, too. They never assign the problems with secular writers. Tell me why secular humanist authors aren't disqualified from writing what they write. Okay? They have secular humanist motives, and they can't be trusted. Yeah. Anyway. Just because they have values and views and, you know, Luke is one of the most amazing historians from the ancient world. It's staggering. You put him up against Josephus, you put him who was total bias. You put him up against Plutarch, you put him up against any of these ancient historians, and he's head and shoulders above all of them. His attention on detail, his focus on everything, and even the throwaway comments that he makes about certain things, every single one of them has been historically documented to the point that you look at Luke the historian with kind of an awe at how accurate he was on the things that he was writing about. And there's nothing else like it from that time period. Okay, I don't care if you want to throw up there Herodotus or Strabo, and every one of them had biases and issues and weaknesses. But from our standpoint as 21st century, you know, scholars, man, Luke was awesome. We can love Luke for the things that he wrote. And we can count on Luke and Acts as being very, very accurate. A hermeneutical objection, and this is where deconstruction comes in and does more damage. Didn't get enough deconstruction last week, and now we got more of it this week. But, yeah. Treating history as literature, Hayden White, more of these. You start highlighting these names and think, stay away, stay away. All right, now he starts to give some responses. And they all fall apart, and usually in the same way. But he takes the time, one by one by one. And clearly, I mean, it all falls under the umbrella, relativism versus absolutism, right? Relative truth, relative certainty, absolute certainty. What is the nature of reality? What is the nature of truth? So some of this is going to be highly redundant from the previous chapters. But the problem of unobservability of historical events. Okay? and Kaiser's more fair. You know, he's so much more fair and academically rigorous. I just read it and say, well, who cares? Okay? Which maybe isn't the most fair response or approach. But he does. He points out here, whatever is meant by objective knowledge of the history they deny It's got to be possible, since in their very denial they imply that they have it. By declaring that we can't be objective, they are asserting that objective history does exist. It's just we don't have it. Or nobody can have it. But even when you say that nobody can have it, you're still acknowledging that it is a concept that can't exist. So how could they know that everyone's knowledge of history was not objective unless they had an objective knowledge of it by which they could determine that these other views were not objective? You cannot know not that unless you know that. Isn't that beautiful? It's kind of simple, but I like the way he puts it. If by objective, the subjectivist means absolute knowledge, well, forget it. Who's going to be omniscient? Who's going to know everything about anything? Of course no human historian can be objective. If that's the standard, if you have to have absolute knowledge, well, nobody has that. But if objective means accurate and adequate, okay, accurate and adequate. Columbus sailed in 1492. It's adequate. It's accurate. Okay, simple. Reasonable people should accept it. And maybe I should have colored that a different color. Reasonable people. I don't think any of these objections come from reasonable people. It seems to me, if you're reasonable about any of these, you're going to side on the Geisler side and not on these people. All right, yeah. So if you go with a better definition, I'm an objective historian with accurate and adequate presentations of the source material, then there you have it. It can be a very objective, very enjoyable history. And it can be just as objective as some sciences. I have no issue with that. He brings up paleontology and all the interpretation they go through. All right. Yeah. What one does with data, that is, what meaning or interpretation he gives to them, can no way eliminate the data. And that's useful, too, because this happens a lot of times. We look at the data, they look at the data, we find a different meaning in it, again, with those presuppositions and assumptions and prejudices and so forth. But it doesn't eliminate the data. The data is still there. The information is still there. And possibly, if a strong case is made and another case is demonstrated to be just horribly weak, then that plays itself out. That gets to, over time, eventually those things just become known, and the weaker interpretations are, you know, sometimes they're recorded and they're laughed at, but they're no longer held truthful by anybody seriously on those things. So, I think one of the biggest examples of this comes in the shortened calendar. The Jewish calendar today is horribly damaged, and it happened in the 2nd century A.D. And we can demonstrate how it happened. You can find whole Wikipedia pages on the missing years in the Jewish calendar. And they clearly took, they crunched the time frame down to reduce the time period from the destruction of the temple to the their day, to the destruction of Babylonian destruction to the Roman destruction, and they just compressed that whole time frame down, by which they had to remove, I forget, 4 or 5 different Persian kings to get the tighter chronology that they were desperate to get a hold of. Well, okay, you can do that, but you're going to get caught, because there's other records, there's other testimony, there's other calendars, there's other descriptions of those events, not just from the Persians, but from the Greeks and from other sources. Eventually the Romans came in, and you have all of these other sources. How can you try to compress, you know, if Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the Jewish temple in 586 BC, we can quibble over plus or minus a year, plus or minus 2 years. Was it 587? Was it 586? 588? We're in that margin of error territory. But we're not in the 320s. We're not in the 300s. Okay? We're in the 580s. We're that's the era we're looking at. But if you want to try to convince me that it was in the 300s, well, good luck. Because objectively, I think it's easy to disprove. And yet That's the methodology they enforced, and it still holds to this day. The Jewish calendar to this day still is built upon that flawed data. Anyway, so the data is still there. The data is still there, and that's kind of a neat thing. The problem of fragmentary accounts. Geisler didn't have a problem with it. I don't have a problem with it. You have enough pieces to put together the whole picture, then there you go. History needs to be no less objective than geology for depending on fragmentary accounts. We're okay with fragmentary accounts. And if more comes to light next year, great, we'll add it to the pile. Well, we're not afraid of it. If more information comes out, that just means more data. We'll include that. These historical understandings are constantly open for future revisions. And there's nothing that we are afraid of because we all have partial knowledge that's going to be improved upon in the future. Fill in the gaps. Value judgments. Yeah. Language is value laden. I don't have a problem with that. Julius Caesar writes about fighting the barbarians. Who's he talking about? Okay, the Gauls. You know, is the word barbarian value-laden? I guess. But from his perspective, what did he consider a barbarian? You know, what did Alexander consider a barbarian? What did, you know, value judgments or language with value-laden terms, it's not a problem. Just know it for what it is in that day and age. And don't try to reinterpret their values with today's woke values. That's stupid. Okay? That's just insane. Yeah, objectivity seems to be demanding value judgments rather than avoiding them. I think he's right. You can't avoid them. You should expect them. Interpret the events within the, ascribe to these events the value they really had in their original context. In their original context. The early American colonists, for example, they had these little European colonies and they were surrounded by a whole continent full of people that they referred to as savages. But nowadays, you can't use that. That word's racist. You can't call them savages. Are you kidding? And so, you know, but that's with today's, is it fair to call them sensibilities? I don't think there's any sense in any of them, but today's norms and standards that say you can't call Native Americans savages, well, they did in their era. That was their terminology, and I'm recording the history of their terminology. Anyway, the historian, if he's accurate about what he's doing, I mean, would you really value a history of the founding of the, the Virginia colony? But if it was written with today's postmodern feminist Nazi whatever, I mean, you wouldn't read a history like that. It would make no sense. You end up with a transgender whoever. Anyway. No, demands value judgments rather than avoiding them. Methodological objections. Not a problem at all. Yes, every historian is a product of his time. Who cares? If he's professional in his craft, if he's skilled in his selection of evidence, and he's objectively reading, I mean, yeah. He's a human being doing what he's doing. I like this. If relativity is unavoidable, then the position of historical relativist is self-refuting. Because his objection is only relative to his perspective. No reason to eliminate the possibility of a sufficient degree of historical objectivity. That's it. It just has to be sufficient. You can even be slanted. Okay? Josephus is very slanted. But you know what his slant is, and so you just read it accordingly, and there you go. Okay? So, he had been free. I mean, why is he called Flavius Josephus? Okay, what was his loyalty to the Flavian dynasty? What was his loyalty to the Roman that gave him his freedom and sponsored his writings and so forth? I mean, he should be a slave. He should be dead. Okay, he's a Jew. He's a Pharisee. He was on the wrong side of a losing war. But he was allowed to write the history of it from the other side. So you just know what his biases are. You know who he's trying to please. You know who's paying his paycheck. So you know who he's going to make look good in the final narrative. And then you have it. But then just because he's doing that, when he gives the sections on and describing differences between Pharisees and Sadducees and Essenes and some of the historical information he gives on the Jewish people, do you think he's qualified to write on those issues? Nobody better. Give me a Pharisee writing on the Phariseeism, okay? Give me an educated Jewish man on the history of the Jewish people. Anyway, just know the slants for what they are and deal with them. Not a problem. The evidence for the historicity of the New Testament, it is greater than that of any other document from the ancient world. I mean, there is not even close. Absolutely not even close. And we have no reason to doubt the historicity of the New Testament. The details of everything the New Testament describes happened the way the New Testament described it. No reason not to take it that way. Greater than that for any other document from the ancient world. That'll come up in bibliology. So if the evidence behind it cannot be known objectively, it is impossible to know anything else from that time period. This it almost gets insulting, too. At a certain point, all of these Bible skeptics, they will accept everything but the Bible, no matter what. No matter how tenuous, no matter how lame, no matter how sketchy. And then they'll reject anything biblical out of hand just because it's biased and you can't trust Christian writers and whatever, until it just becomes impossible to avoid the truth. Okay, well, then they'll begrudgingly say, well, all right, we'll accept this happened because of whatever. We found 600 pieces of supporting evidence. But they don't hold anything else to that same criteria. And they'll just take a single account, they'll take a single witness, they'll take a single idea and just run with it as if, okay, it's now gospel fact and you have to accept it because these educated so-and-sos say that it's true. You know what I'm talking about? Sometimes there's other cases, and this comes up too with manuscripts, with text criticism, because all of the experts tell you that, oh, it had to be that Matthew and Luke were borrowing from Mark, and they had this other document called Q that they were drawing from. Well, wait a minute. None of that's even remotely true. It's just a theory, it's an idea, it's a concept, and there's never been found a single manuscript for Q. There's never been found any, in fact, it's now disproven that there couldn't have been a Q. Okay, in just statistically through some of the work that John Niemöller did on those manuscripts, I think it's certain that there never was a Q related to that. But GEDP hypothesis, or another one. Moses didn't write the Pentateuch. You had a Yahweh author, an Elohim author, a Deuteronomist. You had all these different authors, and then over time, their different accounts were packed together into a thing that now we call the Pentateuch, okay? And it's accepted as fact when it's just a wild satanic theory. And no matter how often you disprove it, the experts will just laugh at you if you don't accept it as being true. All right, then Geisler gives a reasonable answer here to the worldview objections. Again, very patiently. Reconstruction does not necessitate revision. Yes, they're reconstructing the past, but they're not intentionally falsifying it. Yes, you're selecting material, you're excluding other material, of course. Assuming the correctness of this criticism as we do does not eliminate the possibility of an objective understanding of history. Rather, it points to the necessity of establishing a worldview in order to attain objectivity. And really, that's almost the biggest item in this chapter. Okay, far more damaging than these theories about those guys are the attitudes about us. How are we today approaching the text? How are we today approaching the idea of history itself or the idea of epistemology or the philosophy of how do we know stuff? Okay, and I'm almost trembling for what our kids and grandkids are going to deal with because of the nature of what seminaries and colleges, are they training people to think anymore? Or are they just indoctrinating people to repeat the party line. Kind of scary. So now, establishing the evidence for a theistic worldview. Once you're clear on that, you don't really have a problem with these items that follow. All right. Theism provides the sketch on which history paints the complete picture. All right, I'll go with that. The unknowability of miracles. C.S. Lewis puts it well, if we admit God, must we admit miracles? Of course. Indeed, you have no security against it. That's the bargain. Theology says to you, in effect, admit God and with him the risk of a few miracles. I, in return, will ratify your faith in uniformity as regards the overwhelming majority of events. A miracle is a special act of God. If God exists, then acts of God are possible. Hence, any alleged historical procedure that eliminates miracles is bogus. And the reason why it's bogus is because they themselves have started with that as a premise. They've started with that as a given. They've started with that just from the get-go. They said, miracles are not possible, so we're ignoring anything the Bible says about miracles. Well, okay, but right up front, you've told me you're not an objective historian. Right up front, you've told me that you are anti-miracle prejudiced. And so I will accept what you have to say with a huge grain of salt. In fact, I'll probably ignore most of what you have to say, because it's like you just have this grudge you're holding against God's existence, and so you're attempting to interpret God's book with your grudge. Why are you doing that? And why would I even pay attention to you at that point? So, and I think I said this before, didn't I? These are all prerequisites for studying theology. These are theological preconditions. And some of these hostile views are so bizarre, in my mind, that if you truly held them, why are you then studying theology? I mean, really? You're studying theology and you don't believe in a theistic universe? You don't believe knowledge is possible? You don't believe there are absolutes? All right, the testimony for regularity in general is no way a testimony against an unusual event in particular. The cases are different and should not be evaluated the same way. Oh, yeah. Remember this guy, Richard Whatley? He wrote that book about the existence of Napoleon. As a skeptic that, okay, there must not have been a Napoleon because those events were just so unusual and not really possible, and they've never happened before. We can't imagine they'll ever happen again. It just seems like, based on that, that Napoleon Bonaparte wasn't real. And clearly, it's a nice, when you can use absurdity to illustrate absurdity, it's really the methodology at work there. Yeah, he was featured earlier. I forget which chapter, but we've already read that approach. No one can deny that the probability against Napoleon's successes was great. His prodigious army was destroyed in Russia, and a few months later he led a different army in Germany that likewise was ruined at Leipzig. However, the French supplied him with yet another army sufficient to make a formidable stand in France. This was repeated 5 times until at last he was confined to an island. Without question, the particular events of his career were highly improbable. There is no reason on these grounds that we should doubt the historicity of the Napoleonic adventures. History, contrary to the scientific hypothesis, does not depend on the universal and repeatable. That's not the endeavor. That's not the point. That's not the exercise. Rather, it stands on the sufficiency of good testimony for particular and unrepeatable events. So there was something in particular that happened at a certain place at a certain time. What happened at that place? What happened at that time? Who wrote about it? How do we know this is reliable? And if we have sufficient and good testimony, then we go with that. Yeah, you can't approach it as if it's something to be put in a test tube. All right, I think we can get through a lot of this. Have I skipped anything that you've had covered and you wanted me to address? Anything you had questions on? Or I'm up to page 199 now. I'm going to get to the psychological objection. Everybody still awake? All right. Psychological objection. Here we go. The gospel writers, obviously. You know, and for the people that will insert, or they will make the assertion that all of the early Christians were hopelessly biased, they never explained themselves. And if you ask them, well, tell me, what were they hoping to get out of it? Tell me, what were they achieving? What was the? Did they have a financial motive? Were they getting rich off of this? Because none of them did. You know, what were they? You know, and all the nefarious motives that are assigned to them, just throw it back in their case and say, well, can you demonstrate one instance of how that happened? A.N. Sherwin and Michael Grant have responded to this complaint, and these are resources I was going to look up. Roman Society and Roman Law in the New Testament, that's Sherwin White, and then Michael Grant, Jesus, A Historian's Review of the Gospels. I think those would both be excellent additions to my library to get more complete answers to this particular objection. Indeed, a form of this criticism is implied in both form criticism and redactional criticism, by which the gospel writers are said to be creating the words of Jesus in terms of their own religious setting rather than strictly reporting them. Interesting theory, but there's not a shred of proof for any of it. And it's just, in fact, the polar opposite, that they are recounting words that in their day and age would have seemed outrageous. And the fact that they record them accurately and faithfully is itself evidence of its value. Anyway, so how many answers did he give to this? He says, this objection is without grounds for several reasons. And he goes, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth. He's not done. All right, 10 different reasons why this argument is completely bogus. Can we just let it go at that? Or we should spell it out? Okay, we can spell it out. There's no logical connection between one's purpose and the accuracy of the history, he writes. Really? You're going to argue the other side on that? Good luck. People with no religious motives can write bad history, and people with religious motives can write good history. The motive doesn't affect, the output, what they come up with, what they conclude, what they write, is either accurate or not accurate, and that we can deal with it accordingly. He points out here, other important writers from the ancient world wrote with motives similar to the gospel authors, mentions Plutarch as an example, declared, my design was not to write histories, but lives. You ever read Plutarch's Lives? They're actually kind of interesting. They're available. You can get them in Logos if you want them in Logos. So then you can read the English translations and you can read the Greek. And look at the time frame, AD 46. So Plutarch was writing at the same time that the early New Testament was being written. Thirdly, religious propaganda literature, such as some critics see the New Testament, was actually unknown in the ancient world. Find any other example of what they're alleging the New Testament is, it doesn't exist. Honestly, if you understand how expensive it is to write the materials, the manuscripts, the scribes, the actual process was incredibly expensive. Okay, it took the official Roman Empire, it took Constantine the government funds to produce 50 New Testaments. Just realize this is not something that, you know, a bunch of Galilean fishermen that said, hey, we want to invent a new religion and gather a bunch of followers. You know, the idea that they're going to put the materials together to write the New Testament is crazy. But yeah, religious propaganda, that kind of literature, no, it wasn't even known in the ancient world. And Sherwin White addressed that. Unlike other early accounts, the Gospels were written at a maximum only decades after the events. Decades. If that even, right? Jesus died in 33, and then when were the Gospels written? Technically, we don't know. The liberals want to say, well, it was after the destruction of Jerusalem. It was in the 70s or the 80s AD. But there's no reason to take the Gospels written that late. They could have been written in the 40s. Could have been written in the 50s. In fact, depending on how old Matthew was, how young do you think Matthew was to be a Roman tax collector? Do you think it was a younger man? Do you think it was an older man? Because the Romans entrusted him with that duty. And if he was doing that in the 30s, do you think he lived to the 70s or the 80s to write the Gospel of Matthew? I have no problem with John living into the 90s because John was incredibly young in the Gospel record. But Matthew is a tax collector? All right. The historical confirmation of New Testament writings is overwhelming. We'll get more of that in the bibliology portion of this book. The argument that the religious purpose destroyed their ability to write good history is simply contrary to the facts. And the more and more you get, there's an author named Colin Hemmer I really like, who writes about Luke and Acts. There's other authors as well, just describing how, and even throwaway details that we wouldn't even consider, but they so validate expressions and words and terms that are found in the New Testament. I can't wait to get to that part. It's good. You'll like it. The New Testament writers take great care to distinguish their words from the words of Jesus. Now, this is a little bit lame because the red letter editions of the Bible is a modern thing. Okay? They didn't have red letter Bibles for centuries after, you know, Peter and Paul weren't writing with red letter editions. But in the Greek text, whenever Jesus was speaking, they very clearly indicated what was Jesus and what was not Jesus. Paul likewise does the same thing when he says, "This I affirm in the Lord." And he makes that very clear. The words of Christ are the words of Christ, making an honest attempt to separate what Jesus said from their own thoughts and feelings on the matter. Seventh, in spite of religious purpose of Luke's gospel, he states a clear interest for historical accuracy. Let me ask you this. In Luke 1, 1 through 4, how about that? You read this lately? The opening paragraph for the Gospel of Luke is wonderful. "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us." That right there says, wow, something extraordinary has happened, that people are putting details on paper. That's not cheap, but they're doing it. Why? Because nothing like this has ever been done in the history of the world. So they've undertaken to compile an account. "Just as they were handed down to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word." He wasn't an eyewitness, he wasn't there, but he spoke to those who were. "It seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning." Investigated everything carefully from the beginning. You think he was sloppy? Look at how he's describing it. I believe this took place during the 2 years that Paul was in prison in Caesarea. That he was in prison in Caesarea. Luke was with him at that time. It's in the wee portion of the book of Acts. Well, what else was Luke doing? Was he just sitting on the curb waiting for Paul to get out of jail for 2 years? I think he was busy. He used that time to travel all through Judea and Samaria and Galilee. Got to meet these people, talked to the people who were there, people on both sides of the equation who were there, people on the Jewish side, people on the Christian side. So he talked to those who were from the beginning, were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. "It seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus." And so you're going to find there's some sequential tweaks that Luke makes that are different from Matthew and Mark. Matthew and Mark never attempted to write sequentially. They were writing thematically. But Luke will twist some of the event order and he will have some adjustments because this was his stated purpose. He wanted to be sequential. He wanted to be accurate. And he's writing to most excellent Theophilus. That's a curious title. Theophilus is not a nobody. He's a somebody. And Ronald Allen believes that he believes that Theophilus was the son of Caiaphas, that he himself had been a high priest in Jerusalem in the early 40s. And now Luke is writing to him, so that you may know the exact truth about the things that you have been taught. Ooh, the things you have been taught. He's already had teaching on the life of Christ, and now he's going to get an accurate gospel written and dedicated to him. That's pretty cool. All right. And then you can turn to 2 Theophilus, otherwise known as the Book of Acts. You can call this is my goofy names. The Book of Acts, the Book of Luke, I call 1 Theophilus, and then Acts is 2 Theophilus. And here's what he says in Acts 1:1. The first account I composed, Theophilus, about all that Jesus began to do and teach, until the day he was taken up to heaven, after he had by the Holy Spirit given orders to the apostles whom he had chosen. And he just picks up the narrative right from the end of the gospel, and he starts to write more. He takes it from the ascension of Jesus Christ all the way to Paul's Roman imprisonment in Acts 28. And he's giving another historical record. This is why the historicity of the Bible, if you take away the historicity, you don't have a Bible. It was written to be historically accepted. So, Luke's accuracy has been overwhelmingly corroborated by archaeology. I also recommend Titus Kennedy. He has he just published his third book now, and I'm still waiting for the one to come out on the big numbers and numbers, but he now has his third book out there now, and the first one was on Jesus, and then the second one was on the Old Testament. Anyway, good stuff. Titus Kennedy, find his stuff at Amazon, and you will be blessed. Still more objections, or answering the objections. The existence of religious bias is no guarantee of historical inaccuracy. A writer can recognize his own bias and avoid its crippling effects. If this were not so, then even people with non-religious, as I said earlier, the secular humanists, their biases, they couldn't write accurate histories either. And yet they claim that they can do so. Why do we give them a pass? The New Testament is confirmed to be historical by the same criteria applied to other ancient writings. So this criticism either misses the mark or else it destroys all ancient histories. And while that's acceptable, that's true, I don't know that either side has a problem with that. I think they would gladly scrap all ancient history if they could scrap the Bible. They would be very happy to just do away with all of that. But the fact still holds. If the historicity of an event must be denied because of the strong motivation of the person giving it, then virtually all eyewitness testimony from survivors of the Holocaust must be discounted, because clearly they're invested in the events themselves. But that's absurd. Okay? They're the ones that can give the best evidence of all. I like what he says there. A physician's passion to save his patient's life does not negate his ability to make an objective diagnosis of his disease. All right. Response to the hermeneutical objection. How are we doing? I'm on page 200 now. I meant to put my schedule up here earlier. Notes. Reading. Schedule. All right, we're going to get this page. Oh, we're almost done. Page 204. And then next week is chapter 12 from page 205 to 226. All right, so it's an even shorter reading next week. Hermeneutical objection. Utterly fails to show that all history is relativistic. Several reasons why. Any relativism is going to fall short, whether it's linguistic, it's meaning, it's thought, it's logic, it's any of this. Presupposes some objective knowledge. Yeah. Shows how it's self-defeating. Yeah, let me back up a little bit. I should have covered this too. So a careful look at the arguments of the relativist needs reveals that they presuppose objective knowledge about history, and this is seen in at least two ways. First, they speak of the need to select and arrange the facts of history, but if they really are facts, then they, as facts, represent objective knowledge in themselves. Okay, so as soon as they make that premise, they're already giving ground to the fact that these facts do exist. It's one thing to argue that the interpretation of the facts, but quite another to deny that there are any facts of history to argue about. Yeah, that's actually a good way to put that. It is understandable that one's worldview will color how he understands the fact that Jesus Christ died on a cross in the early first century. Okay, but it's quite another to deny that this is a historical reality. And you'll have people that will say, well, there's no evidence that Jesus ever lived. Well, you're not looking at the evidence, and if you make a baseless statement like that, that's just crazy. Because there's more evidence for Jesus than for anybody else in the time era that we're talking about. And it's just ludicrous to try to affirm that. But they can do that with impunity because the people who want to support what they're saying, they don't care about the facts. They want their side to be true. The very fact that relativists believe one's worldview can distort how one views history implies that there is a correct way to view it. They say, oh, your worldview is keeping you from interpreting it correctly. Well, so you're admitting that there is a correct view. There is an objective reality. Otherwise, how would one know that some views are distorted? Some views are correct, incorrect. If you're saying that it's flawed, then you say there's a standard by which the accurate report can be given. All right, self-defeating. It's like historical, philosophical, moral, all of these. Any relative view is going to fall just on its face. And hopefully everybody in this room has gone through this, what, 11 times now in these 11 chapters? We can poke a hole every single time. When someone says, well, there are no absolutes, boom, what have they just done? They've made an absolute statement. So, yeah. How could one know that history was completely unknowable unless he knew something about it? How could he know that all historical knowledge was subjective unless he had objective knowledge of it? In truth, a total relativist must stand on the pinnacle of his own absolutism in order to relativize everything else. The claim that all history is subjective turns out to be an objective claim about history, and so it cuts its own throat. Yeah. He's been doing this in every single chapter. And he gives the Charles Beard quote. But you wonder, did he hate to say this? He kind of had to admit it himself. All right. Yeah, partial relativity. That doesn't help either. It does not eliminate the historical verifiability of Christianity. In brief, total historical relativism is self-defeating, and partial historical relativism admits historically verifiable truth. So when they try to get clever, when they try to admit part, when they try to maybe they admit the absurdity of their view, and so they try to give it some nuance, they try to give it some credibility by having a partial relative claim, then they've already lost. The fact of doing that means they know that that's the direction they have to go, and that's the direction that we're going to take them, whether they want to go that way or not. Historical relativists attempt objective history themselves. This was a thing I heard Ergen Kaner say years ago. He was a speaker at a pre-trib conference at some point. He did a lot of work on Islamic apologetics and different things, and he had a lot of sessions dedicated to destroying deconstructionism. But he pointed out that all these guys that ever wrote on deconstructionism, the idea that you know, words can mean whatever the reader wants them to read, that crowd seemed to write a lot of books. And in writing all the books that they wrote on deconstructionism, they weren't content to let the reader reimagine them in whatever the reader wanted them to say. They expected that their own writings would be read objectively. And he's correct about that. The ability to recognize bad history implies objective knowledge. And that's going to get more and more rare too, I think, intentionally so. So you know, when these different groups come out and they try to have like a 1619 project. And if you're not grounded in real history, how do you point out the flaws of the propaganda that's coming out in the reconstructed history? That's why you got to be solid on these things. Yep, tacit admission that objectivity is possible. Yeah, and they don't live by their own standards. Of course they don't. All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and skip through. Let's see, we've got two more pages left. I'm going to run out of time. Any questions on any of this? Just too tired? Long day? Is it warm in here? All right. It's been the quietest Geisler class we've had since we started. All right, so now take notice of who's missing today, and then we can let them know, because of their absence, we had the quietest and quickest class we've ever had. But don't tease them too badly, all right? We want them to come back. All right. And he might even be watching right now on the church app, for all I know. He probably is. So, we love you. But we do need you back, because nobody else has any questions. All right. So, several general conclusions. Now he's kind of bringing it together at the end of the chapter. Absolute objectivity is possible only for an infinite mind. We're not God, so we're not looking for absolute certainty. We're not looking for absolute objectivity. We're just looking for adequate, sufficient, accurate. Finite minds must be content with systematic consistency. That is, we want to be fair. And we're going to be fair to the facts. We're going to be fair to the history. We're open to revising things. If we add more data to the mix, that's fine. That's fair. So systematic consistency, that is, fair but revisable attempts to reconstruct the past based upon an established framework of reference that comprehensively and consistently incorporates all the facts into the overall sketch provided by the worldview. That is a long sentence, but it's well worthwhile. It is an excellent sentence. Okay, and we learn to do this. We learn to do this through a lot of things. We learn any kind of history, right? You can read a great monument about the victory. Okay, who won the Battle of Carchemish? Okay, it's kind of curious. In the ancient world, you want to read the Egyptian accounts? You want to read the Assyrian accounts? Which accounts do you want to read? Well, the winner is going to write the real accounts. The loser might attempt to write a fictionalized account. And we have monuments like that where, wow, it kind of seems like this was a great victory for both sides of the same war. How did that happen? Okay. But then you can then see, well, what happened in the following years? Quite obviously, this influence departed. This influence was magnified. It's pretty clear that these guys were the winners, no matter what those liars put on their monuments. Okay, and so you learn to filter that. You learn to read accordingly. It's not really problematic in that way. So we have finite minds. An interpretation of history from an absolute perspective is available. Oh, yeah, by the way, are we overlooking the fact that God is omniscient, that God does know everything, and that God's the one who wrote this book? Okay, so we can start with that and say, all right, I believe in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, because the guy who did it said he did it, and we have the record of that. Even without the absolute perspective, an adequately objective, finite interpretation is still possible. In fact, it's normal. We do it all the time. We do it all the time. Okay, we still do it to this day. You read what, I mean, you're watching a news broadcast, and here's what CNN tells you, here's what Fox tells you, and then, you know, keep looking. There's going to be other sources. Do you trust this one? Do you trust that one? Well, what's this agenda? What's that agenda? And you weigh them, and you find, okay, I know something happened. There were explosions and dead people. So now you're starting to put it together. An adequately objective, finite interpretation of history is possible, of course. Systematic consistency, I like that. Systematic consistency is the test for objectivity in matters historical as well as scientific. The worst thing of all is to be unfair, to be illegitimate, to be inconsistent, to handle certain data this way and then other data that way. Why are you inconsistent? No, you want to be systematically consistent, handling these things the same way. So I agree. Yeah, they've got all these objectives. None of them hold any water. They're all kind of, I think they're desperate. I think they're just God-haters that are grasping at straws. History can be as objective as science. And it can be as biased as science. Let's be fair. It can go the other way. If somebody wants to be, you know, a completely fraudulent author of history, they can do that. Like they can be a completely fraudulent scientist. All right, and there's the sources. Quotes himself several times. Here's the Grant work. Michael Grant, Jesus, a Historian's Review of the Gospels. Gary Habermas, there you go. Do you know that name? You ever seen his videos, seen him? Okay. Amazing. There's nobody on planet Earth that has done more work on the historicity of the resurrection than Gary Habermas. And he boils it down to the undeniable truths and makes this compelling argument. Yeah, anything you read by Gary Habermas is going to be outstanding. C.S. Lewis on miracles. Plutarch. And like I say, there's some bad guys here. Paul Tillich and Karl Popper. Richard Watt. Oh, here's the funny one. Richard Watley on the historical doubts concerning the existence of Napoleon Bonaparte. All right. So for next week, chapter 12, you've got 22 pages of reading there, from 205 to 226. That's one of the shorter ones we've had since we started this. Is it the shortest? It is the shortest in terms of pages. So there you have it. And then, so that'll be next week is chapter 12, which is October 29th, next Sunday. And then we get into November, and we'll do the appendixes, and then we'll just keep going. I don't think I'll have to tweak some of this. November 12th, 19th, 26th. I will have a break there, as I am going to Dallas in December for the pre-trib conference. So, yeah, we'll announce that. There will be a break there between weeks 12 and 13. And then we'll have two more weeks, and then we'll take a break for Christmas and New Year's. So just be aware, there's going to be some breaks coming up in the 11 weeks that we're doing bibliology. It'll probably take us 15 weeks to do 11 weeks worth of reading just because of the pre-trib conference and the holidays. And who knows? This one here might be in question. That's my birthday. And there is a Scrabble tournament that weekend in New Orleans that I'm thinking about. But anyway, we'll see. Whatever the Lord wants to do with that. But if we follow this schedule as is, we'll wrap it up by February the 11th. And I think that's a pretty good pace for what we're doing. All right. Thank you, Father, for this day. Thank you for these students. We do pray for those that couldn't make it with us today. And just bring them back at the next opportunity. We thank you. We praise you, Father, in Christ's name. Amen.